Okay, so welcome back everyone, and here we go, 3:30, so I think I break at 3:30, is that right? So we go through to 3:30, okay. Okay, so for this session we're going to look a little bit more closely at some of the texts of early Buddhism, and we're going to learn some of the trade secrets that we use in text critical studies to be able to discern what's real, what's not, what's true, what isn't, and we're going to get a bit of practice at being able to apply these. Okay, now just to clarify a little bit, when I use the word text critical, this is a sort of a technical term that we use, but what text critical studies means essentially is, basically is it just, all it means is really that you take a, you try to sort of take a bit of an objective look at the text that you're dealing with, rather than kind of assuming that everything that you read is going to be, you know, the word of the Buddha or something like that, but you look at it, try to take a step back at it and look at it scientifically. And the field of studies that does that is called text critical studies. And it has, the field has a bunch of methods that it uses. The method is not kind of fixed. There's no kind of one right way of doing these things. And there are many different methods we use, many different criteria we use, and we have to sort of, it's not, you know, it's not like a science, right? It's not like there's a kind of fixed way of going about it, but we kind of play around and look at different things in different ways and try to figure out what's actually going on when we're dealing with a particular text. The field of text critical studies was originally developed to deal with the Bible and with also the Greek and Latin classics. It's made kind of adopted into Buddhism. Having said which, actually the earliest text critical studies of Buddhism that we're aware of was done, that I'm aware of, was done in the 16th century by a Japanese scholar, who, I can't remember his name now, but anyway, he was the first one, as far as I'm aware, to go through all the Buddhist canon and decide what was early and what was late and to give reasons why that was the case. I can't remember the name of the scholar now. He was this kind of genius who lived in Japan, I think, in the 16th century. Anyway, modern text critical studies is done by, and Buddhism is done by about three or four people in the world. And so, you know, if you can all learn a little bit and help out, that would be really good, because it's really not enough. Okay, so why do we do it? Right? The idea of text critical study is not something that we're just inventing off the top of our heads, but actually is related to principles that we find in the suttas themselves. So here's a passage from the suttas. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. When those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, the bhikkhus do not want to listen to them, do not lend an ear to them or apply their minds to understand them. They do not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those teachers spoken by the Tathagata are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, the bhikkhus want to listen to them, lend an ear to them and apply their minds to study them. They think those teachings should be studied and learned. And having learned those teachings, they interrogate each other about them and examine them thoroughly, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? They disclose to others what is obscure and elucidate what is unclear and dispel their perplexity about numerous perplexing points. Okay? So this is just one of many examples in the suttas that gives you an idea of the kind of culture and attitude that the Buddha wanted to develop with regards to the suttas. He didn't want us to put these things on a shelf and just worship them and so on. He wanted us to inquire. He wanted us to discern. He wanted us to know the difference between what is it that the Buddha taught and what is it that the Buddha didn't teach. in the readings that was given for this workshop, a couple of the suttas dealing with the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Anguttara Nikaya, dealt with this point. And the Buddha said that somebody slanders the Buddha if they say what was taught by the Buddha was not taught by the Buddha. Or alternatively, if you take something that was not taught by the Buddha and you say it was taught by the Buddha, that's slandering the Buddha. Okay, so that's something that he clearly, from the early time, we find is something that was a question of concern. How do we accurately represent what it is that the Buddha taught? Okay, so we shouldn't take these things for granted, and we shouldn't just assume that it's for somebody else, or it's only for experts or something like that. But anybody who's interested to understand what it is that the Buddha taught should at least be able to have a grasp of being able to read the suttas and being able to inquire as to them. Okay, so the text we're dealing with, just to summarize what we looked at yesterday, we looked at the different canons and so on, and what actually the content of the early Buddhist texts is. Now, these texts, of course, have been passed down in a physical form through the traditions, and that physical form is... we're missing the bit, are we? We're not getting the whole thing. Let me just try this again. Seems it's a bit flaky. Oops. How's that? Are we getting... Is that getting better? No, we're still not getting the whole thing. Sorry? No, it's not cutting it off. Oh, maybe it's... Is it the projector, is it? Yeah, the projector's actually cutting off on the side. We need to change the zoom on the projector a little bit. Yep. Yeah, because we zoomed it in before when it was too small, so we just need to zoom it back out a little bit. Can someone zoom the projectors for us? Sorry? Good enough. This one? Okay, I need to zoom it out a little bit. Yeah, good. There we go. Okay, very good. Thank you so much. Now it's good enough. Okay, so here's just a very, very brief summary of what we looked at yesterday. In Pali, we have the kind of the ancient texts, of course, but the manuscript tradition is quite late. Okay, we don't have any early manuscripts in Pali, mainly because it's very damp and hot and sticky in most of the Theravadan countries, so all the manuscripts get rotten and fall apart. So the palm leaf manuscripts, the oldest ones, are only a few hundred years old. And earlier than that, there's only a few scraps of pieces in inscriptions and brass plates and things like that. Chinese, most of the texts that we're dealing with were translated around 400 CE. The oldest physical witness we have is much older than the Pali, and that's the Tripitaka Koreana, which is, you see a picture of it there, and that dates from the 13th century. And is everyone familiar with this particular edition of the Tripitaka? Do you know anything about it? You heard about this? Trivikrinda-Bitna? You can have a read in the article on Wikipedia, it'll tell you the story, but it's quite a remarkable physical artifact apart from anything else. This is a carved edition of the Chinese canon made in the 13th century by one of the kings of Korea. I think they were probably celebrating some war or something, you know how kings are. But anyway, so they got these things and they made these wood blocks. They cured them in salt water for like 7 years or something ridiculous, and then they carved each one of them meticulously by hand, built a special building to preserve them in, and they're still in absolutely pristine condition after all these hundreds of years. And there's no mistakes in the whole thing, right? It's all error-free. So this canon is the main basis of the Chinese canon which we use today, is actually copied from this. So, I mean, there are other versions as well of the Chinese canon, but this is the most commonly used one. It's extremely reliable and accurate text, and quite an amazing thing. In addition to that, we have Tibetan texts, which exist in a number of editions, both printed editions and manuscript editions. And unlike the others, the Tibetan text doesn't really have one single sort of standard version that's used today, which is a bit of a hassle for numbering and things. But anyway, and the Sanskrit, there's no particular Sanskrit canon as such, but there are various chance finds of Sanskrit manuscripts from Nepal, Tibet, and so on, or else just out of some rubbish heap in Afghanistan. Sometimes they appear in the black market, and some shonky second-hand camel dealer in Afghanistan will say, "Do you want to buy a manuscript?" And they go, "Okay, what's this?" And then they find, "Oh, it's a 2,000-year-old Buddhist manuscript," and they, "Where did it come from?" And they have no idea. So a lot of these things, quite literally, they just appear in the black market. Many of the texts from Nepal and Tibet were recovered by the great Indian monk Rahul Sankritayana, who's one of the great characters of Buddhism in the 20th century, and he travelled up to Nepal and Tibet in the 30s and 40s and went around to different monasteries and collected whole bunches of Sanskrit manuscripts, brought them back into India, and many of them have been published today. And so in many cases we're able to read in the original Sanskrit classic works, both of Mahayana and Theravada, which formerly were only available in translation. So that's thanks to Rahul Sankritayana. As well as doing amazing, I mean, he's an amazing kind of polymath. He translated several Nikayas, and he wrote, I think, 100 books or something ridiculous like that. He wrote all these kind of novels and Marxist sociological theory and all kinds of things. So he was a quite extraordinary individual. So what am I doing? I'm not going anywhere. Why am I not going anywhere? Okay, so when we talk about all the different versions of this, right, what I want to do now is just present you with an example of a comparison of the same verse in Pali and Sanskrit. And we just want to do this because we talk a lot about the comparative studies, and we talk about the existence of the same text in different languages and things like that. But what do we mean when we talk about that? Okay, so here's just an example. So this is a typical verse. This is quite a well-known one found in the Sutta Nipata and also found in the Vinaya and other places. So chela beheta nipakan sahayang sadhing charang sadhu vihari dhirang abhibhuya sabani parisayani chareyaten atamano satima. So if you gain a discerning friend, discerning. No, it doesn't quite mean that. You gain a restrained friend. Wander together, living well with that wise one. Sadhu vihari dhirang. Overcoming all obstacles, you should wander with him, oneself being mindful. Okay? So there's a translation of that. So this is a very kind of nice verse about the value of spiritual friendship. And in the original context of the verse, it then says, but if you can't get such a good friend, then you should wander alone, yeah, and live alone. So that's the Pali version. Here's a Sanskrit version, or in this case, Gandhari version of the same thing. Gandhari being an Indic dialect characteristic of obviously the Gandhara region and used by the Dharmaguptaka school. It's not Sanskrit, but it has some Sanskrit characteristics, but its own independent dialect. Sache labheya nipakang sapranyang sadhing charang sadhviharadhirang adi buhya sabbani parishva something jareya tenatamano satima. Okay, so you can see, just even if you don't know anything about the languages, you can see that it's almost identical. Yeah, look at the first line. Sache labheya nipakang sapranyang. Okay, so sache labheta nipakang sahayang. So all the same, except for that last word. Yeah. So here it says sahayang, meaning a friend or someone to live together, and this is sapranyang, someone meaning someone with wisdom. Sadhing charang sadhuvihara dhirang, exactly the same. Sadhing charang sadhuvihara dhirang. Adi bhuya sabbani parishva, and this is to note that the manuscript had a gap in it. Right, so we're missing a few syllables in the manuscript. Adi bhuya sabbani parishvayani, abhi bhuya sabbani parishayani. So you can see that clearly, even though we're missing that bit from the manuscript, almost certainly it was just the same as what's found in the Pali, right? So this is when the scholars are able to reconstruct the text. You know, sometimes you can look at it and you know, even though you don't actually have the full phrase, but you know what the phrase must have been. Chareya tenatamano satima, chareya tenatamano satima. In fact, almost word for word, or literally word for word, identical. So this is what we mean when we say that there are these parallel texts and parallel passages and so on between the canons, right? We don't mean that they have some kind of vague generic similarity, okay? We're not talking about texts that simply deal with the same themes or, you know, something like that. We're talking about literally word for word, line by line, identical across thousands and thousands and thousands of suttas, okay? And of course, they're not always so close. Sometimes there are more differences. There's always some differences, right? This is not absolutely identical, but there's no difference in the meaning of it. So there's always minor differences here and there. Sometimes there might be some question about a different meaning, but almost always such differences as there are just sort of minor matters of the expression or the phrasing and don't really affect the meaning. We talked yesterday a little bit about how the idea of backups, right? We talked about this, about how when you make the suttas, you make lots of backups, right? But this is also one of the ways that you preserve the meaning, right? See, in the suttas, you have many cases, you have like repetition of words. So it'll say, you know, and such a person was wise, intelligent, sagacious, inquiring, and so on and so forth. And then people sometimes try to figure out, oh, there must be a special meaning to each one of these words, right? But that's not really the case. Actually, those idioms are really just used there in order to preserve the meaning of the sentence in case anything gets lost or changed, right? You put four words that mean pretty much the same thing. So if one of them gets lost or confused, the meaning of the sentence doesn't change. Yeah. So again, this is that whole idea of making backups of things. And that happens at every level, right? It's not like when we make backups of things on a hard drive, right? You just get your whole hard drive and copy the whole thing, right? So that's like an afterthought, right? The it's just one backup at one level, right? It's the whole thing. But in the suttas, it's at every level, from the word to the sentence to the paragraph to the text to the collect body of text and the whole collection of texts. At every level, the repetition is used in order to preserve meaning, okay, and to ensure that the transmission is accurate. So that when you read it, you know, and you think, okay, you know, I wish they'd get to the point, right? And then remember, okay, don't mean, first of all, why are you in such a hurry, right? Secondly, it's not constructed necessarily for your convenience, okay? Right? This isn't Twitter. Right? And it's constructed in order to preserve the integrity of the information through time, and it succeeded in doing that extremely well. Oh, look, there's some chimpanzees kissing each other. How did that get in there? Okay. I thought text critical stuff would get a bit boring after a while, so I put some chimpanzees in there just to make it more fun. Yeah. But anyway, they're obviously taking the message to heart, right? They've found this as a good friend who they can wander and live together with, practicing. So they're obviously listening to that thing. Anyway. All right. So, what are some of the guidelines that we use in doing text critical studies? So, again, just to clarify, when we say text critical studies, we don't mean being critical of the texts, right? It doesn't mean critical in that way. It just means being able to step back from it and be able to appreciate it objectively. Okay, so here are a few characteristics. So, first thing, linguistic characteristics. Now, purely linguistic analysis, in fact, has a somewhat limited benefit with regards to the Buddhist texts. The main problem being that in the Pali, the texts are mostly fairly unified linguistically, right? It's kind of been smoothed out so that there's not, right? You can imagine if you collect, say, things that have been written by all different people, right, and you put them all in one book, then you can use a linguistic analysis to look at, say, the different vocabulary, different patterns of usage and so on to be able to distinguish who wrote that book. They did that a couple of years ago with a book by J.K. Rowling, right? So she published a book under a pseudonym, and then somebody thought that they knew who that was, and they did like a statistical analysis of the language patterns in there, and they guessed that it was the same author as a Harry Potter author, right, even though it didn't use the name. So you can actually do that kind of analysis. Unfortunately, with the suttas, yes, you can do that to some degree, but you don't get very far because it's quite uniform, so you can't distinguish between things all that much. However, and of course when you come to the translations and the Chinese texts and so on, then it's very difficult to use linguistic analysis. But still, there are some things that we can do. In some cases, we can identify later vocabulary. In some cases, we can identify particular grammatical usages, and in other cases, we can identify characteristics of later literature, such as compounds and meters and so on. Oh, I'll mention meter later. Just double-checking which, so I don't double up too much. And I'll just go over these briefly, but these of course are things which are kind of specialised, right? So this is for somebody who's a Pali scholar. So, you know, unless you studied Pali a lot, you can't really do these things. Some of the other text critical criteria, on the other hand, don't require such detailed linguistic analysis. But I'll just show you some of these examples and you can see for yourself what I'm talking about. Okay, sort of central. What do we got here? Grammatical uses, Kandaparita. Do we have internet? Okay, so okay, so this is a good example, and this is a sutta which some of you may be familiar with, what they call the Kandaparita, and this is one which is still recited quite commonly. Virupa ke hime metang metang rapate hime chabhyapute hime metang metang kanha gotamake hicha apadake hime metang vipadake hime chatupade hime metang metang bahupade hime mamang apadako hingsi mamang hingsi dipadako mamang chatupado hingsi mamang hingsi bahupado sabbe sata sabbe pana sabbe bhuta chakevala sabme bhadrani bhassantu ma kinchi papa magma apamano buddho apamano namo mano sangho apamana vantani sharing sapani ahivichika satapadi urnana bhi sarabu musika katame rakha katame parita patikamantu bhutani sohang namo bhagavato namo sattanam samma sambuddhanam sadhu. So this is a text which is used as, oh, I don't think we have an English translation, is used as a parita, especially in the case of when you have to deal with spiders and snakes and creepy crawly things. So who doesn't like to have cockroaches and these creepy crawlies around the house? Yes? Yes, and who wants to find a better way of doing it than having to put down poison and traps? Yes, so this is your friend, okay? I have people ring me up sometimes and say, oh, there's this spider in my room, can you do some chanting for me? So I have to do this chant for them over the phone to get the spiders out of the house, yeah? And so these are like the different families of snakes and things like that. And at the end, it mentions all the different kinds of animals. This is actually quite nice, the last passage, because most of the animals here have very kind of cute names. Like we have the Satapadi, which is the Sata. Now think about what Satapadi, think what it sounds like and what it means. Satapadi, Sata is 100, Padi is a foot, yeah? Centipede, yeah? Yeah, Satapadi is a centipede. Urnanabhi, right? Urnanabhi, the nabhi is a navel, right? And urna means sticking out. Urnanabhi is the one with the navel sticking out, so this is the spiders, yeah? Yeah? And of course, the easy one to guess is what's the musika, yeah? Musika, the mousy, yeah? The musika, yeah? So. Yeah. Upal. It's for the recording.
You know, is it true that if a snake come to your kuti or something like that, you can recite this and the snake will go without harming you?
That's the theory, yes.
Yeah. No, no. Because I can't remember the first time I'm coming come across this one. Huh. When Ajahn Jnana Dhamma was in Bangkok area, he said there's a Pirit Sutra where you recite that one and they will leave the place without humming.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the one, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yes, this is the one we still use, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Van.
So, yeah, I don't know, it seems to work pretty good. Yeah. So, definitely can't hurt. And so this was a sutta which was given in for that particular purpose. And it says that a monk died from snake bite, and the Buddha said, okay, you should spread metta to all of the families of snakes and so on, and then he gives this thing. But one of the interesting things is that in the original background story of this, in the Vinaya, it gives the setting of it is in Rajagaha, and this is actually grammatically very unusual, because if you know Pali, you know when you do metta like this, it should always be in the locative case. So anybody who studied Pali here would know this should actually be viruba kesu me metang, metang erapatesu me. And the fact that the ehi ending is used is very, very unusual in this particular context. And this is actually an example of the Magadhan locative plural. I know you're all fascinated by that, aren't you? Wow, you're going, that's just so amazing. Right? But remember I mentioned that Pali is actually very well edited and very uniform. And what that means is that when you find occasional examples when it's not so well edited and not so uniform, that it's actually quite striking, right? And we find so this dialectical variation, and it's actually quite telling. Why is that dialectical variation here? Well, I suspect it's possibly because, and most scholars think that the texts were actually formally in something more like Magadhi, right? So Pali is a later standardization. And so when we have forms like this, occasionally the Magadhan, then that's a relic of an earlier time. And I suspect that perhaps these verses were so standard and used so widely in the Sangha and recited in this kind of form that they actually just kind of remained in that Magadhan form, even though the rest of the texts were put into the Pali standardized form. So, of course, it doesn't affect the meaning of it, but it's just an interesting linguistic quirk. Actually, one of the most common word in the Buddhist texts is also a Magadhan form, and that's this one, right? Bhikkhave, yeah, found so many times, all the way through the suttas, monks, right? This is the voice of the Buddha saying, oh monks, right? This is actually not a proper Pali form. It should be bhikkhavo in Pali, but actually it's bhikkhave, which is the Magadhan form. And again, why is it that the bhikkhave form got retained? Well, I suspect it got retained because it's the actual form that the Buddha himself used. Right? And it became so associated with the words of the Buddha and with the actual statements of the Buddha himself that even though everything else was kind of sort of standardized into a Pali, bhikkhave remained in the Magadhan form. So this is like one of the little linguistic details that we can use to discern texts. Okay, so that's a grammatical usage. Another case we can look at is the Anupada Sutta. Anupada Sutta being one of the... One is it? Thank you. Being the... Oops. The... So I hope you're noticing how easily we can use sort of central to find things. If you want to find the sutta, you just write the number of the sutta in there. Our URLs in Sutta Central are beautiful. We sweated for hours over our URLs. Any of you who have ever built a website know what I'm talking about, trying to get your URL sorted out. Okay, so Anupada Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 111, okay? Yesterday we mentioned the term proto-abhidhamma, and this is one of the suttas which is always regarded as being a proto-abhidhamma sutta. It's found in the Majjhima Nikaya, and yeah, of course it's presented as a sutta and so on, but it has characteristics which we normally associate with the abhidhamma. So whereas with the previous example, Kandaparita, the linguistic characteristics tend to identify it as early, in this case the linguistic characteristics tend to identify it as late. We seem to be getting some feedback. Can we maybe turn the volume down a little bit? Thanks. And this Anupada Sutra is a good lesson in text critical studies because it's a good example of a case where we have a number of different criteria which all point to the same conclusion. Okay? And let's have a look at what that means. And we'll have a look at some of these linguistic characteristics. Okay, Majjhima Nikaya 111, Anupada Sutta. That's what I heard. And of course, now, because of Sutta Central, we can all read Pali, and no more years of learning Pali grammar and so on. There you go. It's just there. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Buddha's saying in Savati, in Jetavana Anattapindika's monastery. And there, indeed, the Buddha said to the bhikkhus, bhikkhus, and Bhante, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied to the Blessed One, assented, and the Blessed One said this, wise bhikkhus is Sariputta, of great wisdom is Sariputta, of vast wisdom is Sariputta, of laughing wisdom is Sariputta, of swift wisdom is Sariputta, of sharp wisdom is Sariputta, of penetrative wisdom is Sariputta. Sariputta, for half a month, Addhamasang, developed insight in the Anupada Dhamma. This is actually broken up incorrectly here. It's we have a little engine that analyzes the Pali grammar and breaks up words, so it doesn't always get it right, but we get about 80-85%. So the Anupada Dhamma Vipassanang Vipassati. So the Anupada, whatever Anupada means, Dhamma, the Dhammas, Vipassanang, so insight into the successive Dhammas, something like that. Tatridang bhikkhave sariputtassa anupada vipassana hoti. So this is how he did it. So now there's a few things to notice here, and we'll just notice a few points as we go along for the text critical study. Remember how I just said that the Pali form of monks is bhikkhavo, and we find in the suttas bhikkhave. But notice here, in the introduction, we have bhikkhavo. And then in the text itself, it says bhikkhave. Right? This actually we find very standard right throughout the suttas. But another difference also, in the background we have bhadante, right? And I don't know if we have an example in this sutta, but normally in the suttas when it refers to the Buddha, it will the monks will use the word bhante that we're familiar with, right? Rather than bhadante. Now, in both cases, bhikkhavo and Bhadante are both kind of more formal forms, right? Bhadante is kind of Sanskritic form. Bhikkhavo is more kind of classical Pali. And the forms we have in the oral text is more, a bit more colloquial, more local, okay? So this is a bit like you have in the Chinese schools where the kids sort of want to speak their dialects in the schools and then they get fined and they have to speak Mandarin. Is that right? Do they still do that in Singapore? I was told in Malaysia that this is what they would do. If their kids were caught talking Hokkien in the school, then they get fined and they have to speak Mandarin. So this is kind of like what's happened with the suttas, that there, you know, maybe some dialectical variation, some colloquialisms, and it gets kind of ironed out. So remember, this is the narrative cladding. We talked about this before, right? So this is not the Buddha's voice, this first paragraph. This is the background story. And in that part which is not the Buddha's voice, we see the development of a more formalized, slightly more Sanskritic dialect, okay? Not much different, but just a couple of little points different. That's throughout all the suttas, by the way. That's not just this particular sutta. Okay. So signs of lateness. Why do we think this particular text is late? Why do we think of it as proto-Abhidhamma? Well, first of all, look at the role of Sariputta here. Okay, so it's a fairly elaborate praise of Sariputta, which is a bit unusual for the suttas, right? The suttas tend to be a bit more reserved in these kinds of things. So Sariputta, of course, is always regarded by the traditions as the founder of the Abhidhamma lineage. So the fact that he is being set up and being praised here in a way can be understood as being sort of setting up the authority of the Abhidhamma text. But that's not definitive. That's just a sort of hint. But then when we come to look at the texts themselves, we have some interesting features. Here, monks, Sariputta, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from akusala dhammas and unwholesome dhammas. Savitakang savicharang, vivekajang piti sukhang, patamang jhanang upasampadya viharati. So quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, entered and abided in the first jhana, which has initial and sustained application, and which has the rapture and bliss that's born of seclusion. So this, of course, is the standard formula for the first jhana. Okay, we find this through hundreds of suttas. So that first passage is just a straight out ordinary sutta passage that we find hundreds of times. But then we go onwards, what's the distinctive passages of this particular sutta, and then we see that there's something quite a little bit different. Yeche patame jhane. So what in that first jhana, those dhammas, the qualities of mind or the factors, mental factors that are present in that first jhana, again that usage of the word dhamma in this sense is very characteristic of the Abhidhamma. So those qualities, the vitaka, the vichara, the piti, the sukha, and the ekagata. Okay, so these are the five jhana factors which we find mentioned a number of times in the suttas. Okay, now paso vedana sanya cetana cittang chando adhimoka viryang sati upekha manasikaro. Now this is all getting a bit unusual. Why are we suddenly mentioning all of these other things? Okay, so we have the ordinary jhana factors mentioned here. And as well, we have a list of these other things. These other factors are not mentioned anywhere else in the suttas as being things that are present in the first jhana. Contact, feeling, perception, intention, mind, or citta, curious use of the word mind in that particular context, chanda, enthusiasm, adhimoko is the decision, lack of doubt, viryang, energy, sati is mindfulness, upekkha, equanimity, manasikaro is attention. Now these are mental qualities which are mentioned many different times in the suttas and different contexts. It's unusual to find them in such a long list. Okay, we don't typically find such long lists of dhammas. We never find such a long list of dhamma as the qualities found in the suttas, but also, sorry, as qualities found in the first jhana, but also notice that the form of the sentence has changed. In the first part where we have the jhana factors, right, there's a little cha that links up all the factors. Cha just means and, okay? And in Pali, the normal idiom is you throw a cha in after each word in a list. But you don't have to, right? It's a kind of idiom, you can put it in every one, or you can put it in just at the end. It's a little bit flexible. But notice how the cha is used in those first factors, the jhana factors, but the later ones, there's no cha. Okay? So that's That's a very clear linguistic marker that here we have actually two quite independent lists which have been stuck together, okay? And this is a bit of cut and pasting that somebody's done. So this is a clear sign that this text has been subject to a later expansion. Not only that, then tyasa dhamma anupada vavattita honti. Okay, so regarding those dhammas, there was the anupada, the sequential dhamma, vavattita. Now, vavattita is a very unusual word. You hardly find it at all in the suttas, but it's very common and standard in the Abhidhamma. So this is a particular piece of Abhidhamma vocabulary. It means something like to scrutinize. Okay, so then those dhammas arose, known the dhammas stayed, and known those dhammas ended. Again, this is a passage or a phrase which we find in the suttas, but not in this particular context. So then he reflects these dhammas having not been, they pass away. Then regarding those dhammas, then has another long list of synonyms, right? Again, a bit unusual idiom to have such a long list like this in a particular context in the suttas. Anupayo, anapayo, anisito, apatibhado, vipamuto, visangyuto, vimariyadi katena cetasa viharati. So it means something like he dwelt or he stayed unattached, unconnected, the whole bunch of synonyms to being unattached, freed, released, disconnected, and so on from those things. So this is one of those cases that I mentioned earlier where we have lists of synonyms. Okay, but this is quite a long and extensive one which also has some signs of late vocabulary in there. So atti uttari nisaranamti pajani. So there is an escape beyond that, right? So there is something further than that. And then he practiced that repeatedly, sabbahulikara. So this is just a brief summary of this passage, and then this passage is repeated a number of times. So in this one passage, we've seen a number of different factors which are all suggestive of a later date for this particular passage. The idea that's framed with this elaborate praise of Sariputta, the idea that we're introducing all of these extra factors in the jhana factors, the fact that these factors in the jhanas clearly have two linguistic styles there, which are just sort of bumped up together, and also we find the inclusion of particular Abhidhamma terminology, okay? So in this particular case, we can say with a great degree of confidence that this is a later passage and that this has been either just invented as a way of providing a authority for the Abhidhamma, or perhaps was an earlier sutta which was then elaborated at some date in that Abhidhamma style. And we could perhaps look at it in more detail to discern that. Another factor which is relevant in this particular case is if we look at the comparative study, when we see that this particular sutta very unusually, in fact, has no parallels anywhere, okay? None in the Chinese, none in the Sanskrit, and none in the Tibetan. And that's very unusual for a Majjhima Nikaya sutta, okay? So again, being suggestive of the fact that it was probably developed at a later date. So again, with text critical studies, if any one of those things had been present, okay, we might have, you know, it's just kind of normal, right? You find these things, and we wouldn't make too much of a big deal about it. But when we find multiple indications, all of them pointing in the same direction, and no indications pointing in another direction, then we have a good deal of confidence that this is something which has been later, okay? Now, this particular case is quite unusual. There's not many suttas where we can say with such confidence that it's later. Huh? There are some suttas, there are a few passages in some suttas which are clearly of a later date. But on the whole, most of the material you find in the suttas doesn't suffer from these problems. Okay? So, any questions on this before we proceed? Yes?
I just wanted to make the observation. What the epithets of Sariputta was Hasapanyo?
Yes.
Like the verb vavatita, it's found only in the Pati Sambhita Marga.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's not found in the suttas at all?
I can't find it.
Okay, Hasapanya apparently. Well, there you go. It's found only in the sutta, only in the Parisambhita Magga. Let me just see if that's right. I wasn't aware of that. see what our sort of central search engine turns up. Sapanyo Sangyutta. No, here we go. We have it in the Sangyutta. Dhamme epi sanghe epi hasapanyo javanapanyo. Yeah, so we actually use in the suttas a few times. So I thought it was in the suttas. Patupunya, so this is a similar context. It's a praise of Sariputta. Lakana Sutta, so again later context. Anupada. Pavarana Sutta, again the praise of Sariputta. So most of the time in the context of the praise of Sariputta. And here it's in a verse in the Itiwuttaka. So that's kind of where you might expect. I mean, it's quite a poetic idiom, right? Laughing wisdom, literally. So it's not, you know, it's where you'd expect to find it in a verse. So, yeah. Okay, yes.
Ante, if there are any sutra not starting with evam me sutang, will there be a difference?
Well, many of the suttas, especially in the collections of shorter suttas, the Anguttara and the Sangyutta, very rarely do they start with the proper introduction. They usually just abbreviate it all. Okay, so, but that's just a formal characteristic that they've abbreviated the texts.
I mean, if you say evam me sutang etang, yeah, and another sutra without starting, yeah, is there a difference between those two sutras?
Yeah, like I said, it's just a formal characteristic. So sometimes they just omit it because of abbreviation, so that you can't really draw any conclusions from that, because it's just a convenience of the copyists, that's all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing where the Pali tends to abbreviate these things more. In the Chinese translations, they tend to include them every time. So in the Chinese Sangyutta Agdama, for example, they'll always include thus have I heard, Rusho or when, and then it will go on. Whereas in the Pali, they actually rarely will include it. They usually abbreviate. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Okay. So, yeah.
Bhante, I learned that, I don't know whether it's true, that some suttas that recited by Venerable Ananda starts with Evammi Sutta. Suttas that remembered by other monks start differently.
Yeah, not really. Yeah, this is, according to the tradition, they say that evam me sutang, I'm just trying to see, was the words of, I guess, no, I can't remember how it is. That these are the words of I think that's it. Right. That the according to the tradition, the words evam me sutang were the words of Venerable Ananda at the first council, but that's clearly not the case. In fact. Sorry, I'm just looking for the exact case here. No, I can't find it. In fact, that's not the case. The word evam me sutang is an idiom in Pali, which means I have heard it passed down through the oral tradition. Okay, that's what it actually means. There's a sutta, for example, where Venerable Anuruddha is talking to one of the laymen, and one of the laymen asks him about whether he had seen any of the orders of devas, right? And Ananda says, well, that's very rude of you to make that kind of inquiry, right? But anyway, he goes on to talk about the various kinds of devas, right? And the layman says, it occurs to me, Bhante, that you don't say evam me sutang, right? In other words, you're not saying this is something that I've heard, you know, from somebody else, right? But you speak as if you were there and present and saw it yourself, yeah? So clearly, the word eva mesutang specifically means I was not there, but this is something that I heard, okay? And of course, Venerable Ananda was in fact there at least many of the times, if not most of the times, when the Buddha gave his discourses, yeah? So he wouldn't have used that idiom if that was actually the word that he used. The idiom that's used in Pali to refer to something that you actually saw face to face is this particular idiom here. Desame sammukhasutang sammukhapatigahitang. And I was just thinking of trying to find an example where it a contrast to those two. But here we have, for example, this is what when Ananda was actually quoting something that he had heard and learnt from the Buddha himself. This is the phrase that he would use: "Sammukha me avaso bhagavato sutang sammukhapatigahitang." This, friends, is what I heard personally from the Buddha. This is what I heard. This is what I learnt face to face with the Buddha. Yeah, sammukha means face to face with, and so this is what Ananda would say if that was the words of Ananda. Yeah? So the word eva me sutang isn't the words of Ananda at the start of the sutta, it's the word which is acknowledging this is something which is passed down through an oral tradition. Okay? Yeah.
Question. Yeah. Before the Sunday service this morning, we went through the Nalanda Sutta and we learned that for samadhi, the mind goes through satipatthana. Satipatthana, I would relate satipatthana with the practice of vipassana. The practice of vipassana doesn't take the mind to the jhanas, right?
Is that a question or a comment or?
This is the impression I have. The practice of vipassana doesn't take the mind to jhana. Is that correct?
I wrote a long book about that called The History of Mindfulness, which contains a lot of arguments on that in detail. So you're most welcome to go and have a look at that. But in brief. I think this is an area where text critical study is, I think, very useful and very interesting. And actually, this is where I learned a lot about text critical study, was by doing the study of the Satipatthana Sutta in particular. And I haven't actually included a lot of that in the course, one of the main reasons being that once I get started, well, we could be here for a long time. I've done several sutta classes on that, which typically go for a 5 or 6 hours for one class on one sutta, so you're most welcome to endure those if you feel the need. But first thing is that if we look at the Satipatthana Sutta in comparative light, we find about 6 different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta across the Chinese and Sanskrit and so on, right? Now, if we look at the similarities and differences between them, one of the striking things is that the passages which most clearly refer to vipassana practice are precisely those which are not common across the different versions, okay? So, for example, the passage is talking about contemplating the origination factors in those dhammas and the dissolution factors and things like that, and those passages aren't common. But if you look at the way Satipatthana is taught most of the time in the suttas, okay, we find this from two ways, right? On one hand, Satipatthana is rarely, if ever, associated with vipassana. There's only one or two passages in the suttas where Satipatthana is actually associated with vipassana. On the other hand, when we look at those passages which actually do teach vipassana, of which we have many hundreds, okay, Khanda Samyutta, Dhatu Samyutta, Salayatana Samyutta, and so on, we find hundreds of suttas talking about contemplation of impermanence, contemplation of suffering, contemplation of not self, and so on. That's what vipassana is, right? None of them mention vipassana. Sorry, none of them mention Satipatthana. Okay? So in those places where we would expect to find Satipatthana talked about, right, if that was what vipassana practice was, we find nothing, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of suttas and not a single mention of Satipatthana. Okay? Normally, the normal situation in the suttas, if you look at the Eightfold Path, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, right? And this is regarded as the samadhi kanda of the Eightfold Path, right? The samadhi section of the Eightfold Path, not the wisdom section. Vipassana is wisdom, right? Why is Satipatthana living in the samadhi section of the path if it belongs in the wisdom section of the path? Did the Buddha do some misfiling? Did he not quite know where these things belonged? I suspect not, right? I suspect that actually the Satipatthana section is put in the samadhi section because that's where it belongs, okay? And because the purpose of Satipatthana is to lead into jhanas, yeah? Yeah? Like I said, this could go on for some time, all right? So, yes.
Bhante, sorry, I mean, when I was hearing the analysis that you make with regards to the linguistic patterns of Anupada, which suggests there's a later text, and it seems that it's a cut and paste portion, does it mean that this particular suttas is not spoken by the Buddha, or...
Probably, yeah.
Then how do we actually differentiate within the Nikaya, which are the suttas that is really spoken by the Buddhas, especially we don't understand Pali, because it's all translated, you could have lost the linguistic patterns.
Well, that's right, yeah. So there are various things that we can do. We can never have 100% clear-cut answers to these. And remember yesterday I pointed out that it's a little bit like the difference between climate and weather. Right, so it's a bit hard to say, is it going to rain tomorrow? Okay, but we can certainly say, well, there's a rainy season and there's a pretty good likelihood it's going to rain in the rainy season. Okay, so we can't necessarily say every sutta, every passage, can we say exactly that this passage was spoken by the Buddha? Yeah, it's a bit difficult to say. But on the other hand, we can say that the collection is likely derived very closely from what the Buddha taught. Okay, now there are some times when we can look at texts more precisely and be able to have more confidence, either that it is early or that it isn't early. Okay, and the Anupada I was using as one example of that. The Anupada is unusually clear, which is why I chose it as an example. Most of the suttas we can't tell so clearly. There may be one or two hints or indications here and there, but we can't always tell. The linguistic analysis is only one kind of analysis. So I'm starting out with this one, and in a little while we'll look at some other kinds of analysis that we can use. So even though if you don't know Pali, you can't obviously do the linguistic analysis, but some of the other kinds of things you can. Okay? So, yeah, so some things, either you have to leave it to the experts or become an expert. Easy. Learn Pali.
Sorry, I have a subsequent question to that. So even though we are not able to differentiate that it is part of the Nikaya, could it have mean that, you know, somehow some information has been lost and it is a summarized, well, very similar to the same thoughts as what Buddha has intended to taught us, but then you probably is not expressed in the same way because it's really not exactly the words that Buddha speak. Would that be the intention? Or, you know, if the linguistic pattern shows that, or whatever evidence suggests that it may not have been Buddha's words, yeah, then we should not take it so seriously. What is your perspective?
Well, I don't think we should be too dogmatic about it. We need to look at each case, and just judge it on its merits and try to assess what's going on. That's all. It's a bit hard to we shouldn't be too hard on things. I think one thing is I definitely think we should make an assumption of goodwill and integrity on behalf of the Sangha, right? I think that's perfectly reasonable. And the Sangha did a very good job, right? And the fact that there are some, that you can look at a 2,500-year-old ancient text of millions and millions and millions of words and find some problems with it is not difficult. Okay? I mean, it's like if you've ever been a teacher or marked people's essays, yes, you can find some spelling mistakes and some things like that in there. On the whole, right, the purpose of and the intention of the Sangha in the early times was to preserve the words of the Buddha. Yeah? And so I think it's only reasonable to assume that that's what they actually did. Yeah. So in some cases, obviously it wasn't perfect because, after all, you know, we're dealing with worldly dhammas, right? I mean, the dhamma itself is pristine, but its expression in language is just a worldly construct at the end of the day. And so it'll never be 100% perfect. Yeah. So we just do our best. Yeah. So hopefully during this course we'll learn a few bits and pieces that'll help us to distinguish. Yeah.
Setting aside the question of what is exactly the words that are used, in the actual experience of first jhana, is it only the five factors are being observed, or the longer list are also observed?
Or the longer list?
The longer list, including the paso and the rest. That is a more important question than who exactly said which words.
Is it the more important question? So his question was, leaving aside the textual question, was in the first jhana, can you only see the five normal jhana factors, or can you see those other factors present as well? Okay. Well, I would say in the first jhana, you're not particularly going to be worried about that. You're more like, hey, yeah, this is really cool. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And so, you know, when you reflect on it and you investigate it and so on, then the overwhelming thing, I think, which is the impression, is that those things which are distinctive about that experience, and that's what the jhana factors are, right? They're the things which actually define that particular experience. The other factors are usually those things which are common in the Abhidhamma. They call most of those what they call the Sabbasadharana Jetasika, which means the universal mental factors. They're present in all moments of consciousness. So, you know, they're not something which distinguishes that particular state of mind very clearly. So I'd say certainly the jhana factors are what's clear and what's important about that experience, but the other things are probably there, I guess, in the background maybe. Yeah. Mind's complex, always made up of these different aspects. Yeah. Okay. Where were we? Oh yes, Lakkhana Sutta. So Lakkhana Sutta is another good example of a late sutta, which we can again tell is late because of a number of different characteristics. Again, if we look at the comparative study, the Lakkhana Sutta kind of has a parallel. In Sutta Central, we use this asterisk to indicate a partial parallel. What that means... What that means is that there's many different... Well, essentially what that means is that this sutta has something in common with the main sutta, but it's not all that close. But it means you might want to investigate it. In fact, the Lakkhana Sutta deals with the 32 marks of the great man, which many of you may be familiar with, and which are found a number of times in the suttas. The Chinese version basically just has a list of those 32 marks. It's much simpler, whereas the Pali version of the Lakkhana Sutta is very elaborate, and all of those elaborations are absent from the Chinese version. I won't go into too much detail here, but just to point out that like the Anupada Sutta, with the Lakkhana Sutta we have a number of different characteristics which indicate lateness, both in terms of the doctrine that's discussed, like the idea of the 32 marks of the great man is a bit weird anyway, and the fact that they've gone into such a great deal of length to describe each one, talk about the karmic causes of them and so on, is also a bit kind of weird. But each of the marks of the great man is accompanied by a set of verses, and you can see the verses that's used here, and these verses are in a very late metrical style and a very late linguistic style, and you can see some of that in the length of the compounds that you find here, and this is very characteristic of later Pali. Sukata Pallavi Pakamanu Bhutva. Wow, what a long word, right? Yeah, Vimala Sukumachaving, and we have a Achadana Watamoka Pavuranana, right? Okay? And they get longer and longer as they go on, yeah? I know. Now, Interestingly enough, you know, this actually becomes a technical problem for us when we're doing Sutta Central, and I don't kid you, because in the later literature, the compounds become so long that they just go right off the side of the page, right? I'm not kidding, like they just go for miles. And so we had to develop a hyphenation engine to be able to hyphenate these things so we could actually keep them on the same page, right? And so what's going on here? Well, you can think of this as a decadent linguistic style. Okay, this is where the language is moving away from being a colloquial spoken language to where it's being a highly formalized, elaborate, fancy literary language. And these long compounds that we find in this Lakana Sutta are very characteristic of literary Sanskrit and the literary forms that emerged in Indian literature in that later period. So when we see, of course, you know, you might find occasional long compounds in the early suttas, but you don't find them so commonly and with such kind of elaborate emphasis as you do here in the Lakana Sutta. So this is another fairly clear sign of lateness. And once again, it's combined with many other things in this particular sutta. So here we have one compound, the whole line, yeah? Bahu vividha nimitta lakkananyu, and so on and so forth. And so again, you know, to find multiple cases where the whole line is just one compound is not something that we find in the early verse at all. Okay. Maybe. Oh, we should probably break and have some. What's the time? Oh, no, what time are we? Oh, 3:30 break. We forgot to have a meditation break. Okay, let's have a quick meditation break before a half. And we'll look at some of the other criteria that we can use for theoretical studies. And I will go over these in brief. Metta is another one. Now, we've looked at the fact that in Pali texts we quite frequently have verses. And those verses have a meter, that is a rhythm which is characteristic of the verses. And if you've ever studied like poetry in English and traditional poetry and so on, you'll know that has the same kind of thing. The study of verses in Indic literature is an extremely old one and an extremely sophisticated one, because the oldest texts, the Rig Veda, are metrical texts, and the Buddhist verses inherit that literary style from the Vedas. Like any other characteristic of language, the meter of poetry has an evolution. It doesn't stay still. It changes according to fashions and so on. And generally speaking, the evolution is from a looser and more colloquial style towards a more formal, elaborate and sophisticated literary style. And the time of the Pali Canon and a bit after the Pali Canon was kind of on the cusp of that change from the older styles we find in the Vedas, which we also find some of them in the Pali Canon, to much later styles which we find in Sanskrit literature. Some of those also found in the Pali Canon, especially in the Lakana Sutta, which we just looked at. And in some cases we find the same sutta, the same text, will have examples of both of those different kinds of things. I won't go into examples of that because it might take a little bit long, and I'd like to get onto some of the other ones. So I might leave that one aside. Also, that's another one which needs to be, you know, you need to study that in the Pali to be able to understand it. Okay. Full disclosure, I should also say, the other reason I'm not going to discuss it in detail because I don't know it in all that much detail. There's very, very few people who are experts in the verse styles of Pali. And of those few, one of them is Venerable Ananda Jyoti, who's living in Taiping at the moment. And he's the one I go to if I've got questions about Pali meter. Text critical criteria. Okay, here's some other things which we find useful, and this is one that doesn't require you to know Pali, but you can just look by reading the text. The doctrinal evolution, the shift between earlier teachings and later teachings. We've remarked a little bit about some of the evolution in the idea of the Bodhisattva. Venerable Anālaya did a book about that a few years ago, which examines that in some detail. We've also looked at the Anuppada Sutta as an example of the Proto-Abhidhamma, and there are a few other texts which also have similar kind of influence, perhaps none so obvious as the Anuppada Sutta. Generally speaking, we can say that in the Buddhist texts, or generally speaking in the history of ideas, that later ideas assume the earlier ideas, okay? So that the texts sort of build on each other in layers, and that very often a new generation of texts and so on will address questions which were left over from the previous generation. Okay, so that the generations of Buddhist texts, in a sense, have there's a dialogue going on in time as each text and is answering or correcting or responding to or filling out issues with the previous generation. Of course, that's what we do these days, isn't it? Right? If I'm going to write a book, I don't write a book. You know, you're not going to find me writing a book, you know, how to be mindful in daily life, okay? Why not? Because it'd be boring. Because a dozen people have already written that book. And you can go and buy perfectly good books about that, and I don't have anything to say about that, which those other people haven't said probably a lot better than I could say. So I'm not going to bother writing that book. But what I might write a book about is something which other people have not said. Or something which says, actually, there's this aspect of it which has been overlooked, or there's another way of looking at it. Yeah? And so we write, we respond to things in the previous generation. Okay, so when you become sensitive to this, you become familiar with the ideas that we typically find in the suttas, and then how that developed and changed. Then you can see, oh, okay, there's this shift over time. And that this doesn't just happen with one or two things. It happens with every single idea that we find in Buddhism, okay? Every teaching that you're familiar with in Buddhism evolved over time in terms of its expression. And we can use that to trace the earlier and the later suttas. Another very, very important criteria is the comparative study, okay? And this is, of course, what sort of central is built on is the notion of the comparative study of the different texts. And let's just have a look. This is the Digha Nikaya we're in now. And so this is the table that gives you the parallels here in this column for the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, Brahmajala Sutta number 1. And we can see this has a number of different parallels. Chinese canon, several parallels, Sanskrit fragments, and Tibetan editions, we have several. So it has a broadly distributed set of parallels, huh? Similar with the Samanyapala Sutta and so on. Actually, most of the suttas in the Digha have several parallels. So this is giving us a hint that these suttas are quite widely distributed across the different traditions. Some suttas like Mahaparinibbana Sutta very obviously has very many parallels, yeah? That's one of the most sets of parallels of anywhere in the canon. Another sutta, like say the Janavasabha Sutta, if you're familiar with that, is a much more obscure sutta and only has a couple of parallels. Yeah? So this can give us an idea, a hint, as to what things were likely to be early and what things are likely to be late. We already pointed out that the Lakkhana Sutta hardly has any parallels at all. However, this is the criteria which should be used with caution, and we need to not jump to conclusions. In some cases, the presence or absence of a parallel is merely a matter of luck. Okay, it just so happens that a particular collection has been preserved that has that sutta, and perhaps there might be another collection which originally had it, which just hasn't been preserved. Okay, so there's an element of chance here. So we can't sort of rush to too many conclusions about the presence of parallels, but certainly we can use it as one of the indications to give us a guide for the authenticity of the text. Okay. What's more useful though is to look in detail at what the actual text contains, and to look at when we look in detail and compare the different suttas, and we can see what they have in common and what they don't have in common. In some cases, we can see that a much shorter version in Pali might have a much longer version in Chinese, or vice versa. There might be a short version in Chinese, a much longer in Pali. And typically, it's most likely that the extra material was added at a later date. It's much more common for texts to grow over time than it is for them to shrink. Okay? Why? Well, think about it. If your job is to preserve the text, right? So this is your sacred duty, okay? You have to preserve the Buddha's words, right? So you're going to be completely paranoid and terrified that you're going to forget a single word, and you're going to do everything you possibly can to remember everything, right? You don't mind repeating things, right? You don't mind making it kind of longer and padding it out as long as the original core is still there. So you're much more concerned to not lose something than you are worried about adding things. So typically we find that over time texts may expand somewhat. Rarely do they shrink. Occasionally they might. They might accidentally lose a sentence or a paragraph or something here and there, but typically we find that they tend to expand. Another important difference that we find through the comparative study is the distinction between the teachings and the narrative background. This is something we also already remarked upon yesterday, that when we compare the suttas, when we see the teachings, which is the body of the sutta, is almost always identical between the two versions, but the beginning and the ending of the sutta may well be different. So it's probably about... You know, with the origin stories, there may be a bit hard to say, but I'm thinking, yeah. It's quite common that the same sort of the same teaching will be found in Sarvatti in one case, in Rajagahara in the other case, or something like that. And so those incidental details of the setting may well be changed, but the content isn't. There's an interesting passage that talks about that, which is found in two of the Vinayas, which we have in Chinese, and that talks about what the monks are supposed to do if they forget the suttas. Okay? Now, this is very interesting because it's giving an insight into actually how this thing was done in the community. Nothing like this we find in Pali, but in two of the Chinese Vinayas we have it. And it has, and it basically it says something like this, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like this. What happens if a monk is reciting and they can't remember the setting of the sutta, then they should say it's in one of the great cities such as Sarvatti. Okay? Yeah. If they can't remember who the king was who was in the sutta, they should say it was either Pasenadi or Bimbisara. Yeah? If they can't remember who the layman was, then they should say it's an Atapindika. If they can't say who the laywoman was, they should say it's Visakha, and so on. Now, notice what it's saying here. None of those differences actually affect the content of the sutta. Right? That's all about the narrative background, right? So the incidental details, then, yes, as we see, the incidental details might change from one to the other, but they're not actually changing the content of the sutta, okay? The meaning of the sutta is the same, but just bits of the details of it, the setting might change a little bit. So, you know, you can see that if you had that kind of guidelines in the Sangha, that, you know, you would very quickly produce a body of texts where most of them were set in Sarvatti, which, of course, is actually where they were. So when we find texts that are set in Sarvatti, for example, if you find one sutta is in one version it says it's in Sarvatti, another version says it's in, say, Vesali, right? Where was it? Well, most likely actually it was in Vesali, okay? Because if the monks forgot, they would have said it's in Sarvatti, right? So by default, you keep on switching back to Sarvatti. It's like when you're doing a Word document and you try to do something that's not in Times New Roman and it keeps on coming back to Times New Roman no matter how many times you try to reformat it, right? So that's a bit like it kind of everything keeps on falling back to Sarvatti, yeah? So this is, this again is just a characteristic of how the literary shape of these texts took form. Okay, another text-critical criteria that we can use, the relation to historical events, places, persons, and social structures, and so on. And, of course, we looked at this to some degree yesterday, and we have a lot more detail on that in the book that Venerable Brahmali and myself did last year called The Authenticity of the Ancient Buddhist... Authenticity of... What was it called? The Authenticity of... something about authenticity, anyway. And... So we went in a lot of detail into all of these things, like the historical events and so on and so forth. So, and that book was meant as a kind of a reference work and for people who are interested in studying suttas, so that if you come across a particular aspect or particular thing you want to find out about, then you can refer to that. So that's a good one. You can download that from the Oxford website, Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies. So when you see things that mention the cultural, social, historical events which are characteristic of that period, then that confirms that it belongs to that period, otherwise that it's later. one of the questions which is a kind of a social issue at the time was the social relation between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas were trying to assert that they were the highest caste in society, and the Brahmins were trying to assert that they were the highest caste in society. And at that point there was a bit of a tussle between them. At a later date, sort of the Brahmins won, and they came assumed that the Brahmins were number one in society. But at the time of the Buddha, it was a bit less certain. So this is just another sign of a contemporary social issue. Okay. Other texts critical? Yes, please. Yes. Please. What do they do? Kshatriyas. They're supposed to be like a warrior. They're basically an aristocratic class. So they were landowners. The word Kshatriya possibly is derived from the word kheta, meaning field. But they were also regarded as warriors. So, there was something like in sort of medieval times, the kind of the lords and the knights and this kind of thing. Yeah. There was a lot of overlap, though. The Brahmins have this kind of idea of like the purity of the Brahmin tradition and things like that, but actually you find Brahmins doing all kinds of things in the suttas. They were farmers and all kinds of things. So the separation between these different castes was never as clear-cut as the Brahmins like to pretend. I mean, this is something you find in the Brahmin texts themselves, right? There's a lovely Brahmin sutra, a passage in one of the Upanishads that talks about a young man who, what was his name? His name was, there's something like Satchika. It wasn't Satchika. Come to me in a minute. And he wanted to go forth and study with the Brahmin priest, right? And he'd been brought up just by his mother, and he'd never known his father. So he went to his mum before he said, "Mum, I want to go and study with this Brahmin priest and become become an expert in the Brahmin tradition, and they'll ask me about my lineage, so I need to know who my father was." And the mum says, "Well, you know, son, how it is, and you know, when you're young and you kind of wander, get around a little bit, and I'm not entirely sure who your father is," as it happens. And so he went to see this teacher, and the teacher says, "So who is your father?" And he says, "Well, you know, my mum got around a little bit and stuff when she was younger, and she's not entirely sure who my dad is." And the teacher says, "Oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Somebody so honest and so straightforward can only be a true Brahmin." Yeah? Yeah? And, you know, which is a very kind of Buddhist message, right? That being a Brahmin is actually about your ethical integrity and your honesty and so on, and not about your lineage, yeah? And so, but that's found in a Brahmanical text, right? So this is this idea that it's all about lineage and birth and caste and things. It's never as clear-cut as that. Yeah. Okay, so some direct textual evidence. So there are things in the text themselves which will tell us whether they're early or late. For example, sometimes the difference between narrative and teaching we've already discussed. Sometimes it's a matter of the text themselves will say, you know, this happened after the Buddha died, right? It'll actually say this was set sometime after the Buddha died. Sometimes there's a few suttas we find that feature kings who only came to power after the time of the Buddha. In one or two suttas like that. Sometimes they're attributed to people or to events that happened at a later time. So sometimes we have that thing to help us. And a part of sutta we've already looked at. Okay, so then we have the Chanki Sutta. So what I'm going to do, we've got 10 minutes before the break, so we'll have time for some more questions. And then after the break, we'll come for our next discussion session, okay? And in that discussion session, I'm going to assign you a sutta, and you're going to have to take that away and work out whether that's early or late, and what bits are early and what bits are late, okay? So, all right? Yes, you're shaking your heads. No, you can't get out of it. And lock the door. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Anyway, got 10 minutes for questions.
Ajahn, just refer to your early teaching. Yep. When Buddha, when he gotten the enlightenment, he first thought is not to teach, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem sounds very compassionate for me because it sounds a little bit contradictory. What is your comment on that? I thought if he's enlightened, he would naturally want to, you know, help all the being enlightened.
Yeah. Well, interesting. I don't know. I mean, one thing to remember in that context is, you know, it is a legendary context. You know, you have Brahma coming down to invite him and so on. So, you know, clearly it has a kind of propaganda value in the sense that it was used to sort of, you know, to try to convince the Brahmins that even God wants me to teach this Dhamma, right? So, you know. So it clearly has that propaganda element, and it's also an element in a narrative. I mentioned before that the whole purpose of narratives is to have tension, right? And that's what drives it, yeah? So you get to this point, you imagine, you know, this is a real kind of cliffhanger moment, right? You've got the enlightenment, everything's like that, and then it's like, oh, everything's good, and then it's like, but wait! Oh my God, he's just going to disappear, no! And so you're waiting on tenterhooks, what's going to happen, right? So this is where you introduce these moments, yeah? But also it's a reflection, right? It's a reflection that actually this Dhamma is something which is very subtle, something that we should, you know, not take for granted or anything like that. So I think it performs a number of, you know, important roles, very interesting roles as a narrative section. Whether it's a historically accurate section, I'm not entirely sure. Personally, I don't have a problem with it as such. My own opinion would be that I don't think the Buddha had really thought about this beforehand, right? If you look at what we saw before with the Majjhima 26, you know, I want to get out of suffering, you know, I want to find freedom from all of these things, and that's what he was concerned with. And when that had happened, right, then his thought goes, well, what next? Yeah. And so then you can imagine that he'd go through that process. Well, what should I do? Should I teach? Should I do this and so on? So I, you know, to see that as a reflection for that process, I don't, you know, I don't have a problem with that. Yeah. Yeah. But again, if he wasn't going to teach, it was not because he didn't care about people, but because he, there's a difference between not caring, right, and then accepting that there's nothing that you can do, right? I mean, his point was that the Dhamma is so subtle that no one will understand it, yeah? So it wasn't that he didn't want to help people, but that he wasn't sure whether he could, yeah? Yes, so it's the hand over here, yes.
I can't have a following question.
Sorry. Yeah, probably best to have another questioner if possible. Is that okay?
Ajahn, questions on the... Is that all the Arahant has all the psychic power, being able to read other people's minds?
No.
Does Shariputta have such abilities to read other people's minds?
It doesn't really talk about it in the suttas. Yeah, he does say in his Theragata verses that he didn't practice for the sake of gaining those psychic powers. So, but that doesn't mean he didn't have them. But whether he did or not is a bit, seems to me, a bit uncertain from the suttas. Yeah.
Certainly
doesn't make a big deal about it.
Yeah. The reason why I asked you a question, just now you mentioned about one sutta that Buddha had a discussion with Sariputta. He said that he cannot have access to other people's mind to understand.
He said he can't read the Buddha's minds. Yeah. So this is again why the sutta's not entirely clear. He can't read the Buddha's mind, right? That's a bit different.
So he doesn't allude to, he cannot read other Arya's mind.
Yeah, it doesn't say. Yeah.
Another question is regarding the Satta.
Could you maybe have someone else ask a question? Sorry, but they're probably, you know, they've only got a few minutes, so give chance for someone else.
Oh, hi, Bhante.
Yes.
Just now, in one of the slides, you say what text, and you just mentioned only the Pali, the Sanskrit, and the Chinese. Then you also mentioned Korean, but the Japanese Kaisho texts are not included. Is it because...
Sorry, perhaps it wasn't clear enough. Okay, texts, okay. Yeah, the Chinese, there's the East Asian canon, right, is in Chinese. And so that Chinese canon was then exported to Korea and Japan, but they basically maintained it also in classical Chinese. So it's basically one canon is the Chinese canon, which was studied. So this is even though it's in Korea, it's in Chinese characters. It's not a Korean translation of the Chinese canon.
Yeah.
And the same in Japan. Yeah.
But
as you said, the edition of it that we use today is the Taisho edition, which was done by a Japanese university. So it's a Japanese university published edition of the wooden tablets found in Korea, which is a version of the Chinese canon. It's all a bit confusing, I know.
Yeah, thanks. Because I think the Japanese and the Koreans actually learn everything from China. So, and then
I think that words those ones.
No, but those scripts.
There's no Japanese actually, in here.
I mean, when I'm referring to learning from the Chinese, I'm referring to actually the Buddhist text itself.
The Buddhist text, yes. As far as we know, right. they all came via China to Korea and Japan. Yeah.
And the Japanese have three or four types of scripts, I understand, and one of them is actually the Chinese text, and
that's
so are
right,
the Koreans.
Yeah.
And then now, of course, the Koreans use their own text now.
That's right, yeah.
Thanks for clarifying.
Yep.
Bhante, we have a Korean sister here.
Ah, excellent.
Sitting up front.
Okay.
She's looking at me with big eyes.
Where's our friend from Korea? Ah, welcome. Yes. Okay. Other questions?
Ajahn, I have two unrelated questions. The first question is with regards to the Sutta Central website, because I hope to share the website with some of my Buddhist friends, and I just wish to ask, at this point in time, is the entire Pali canon and the English equivalent already in the website, or is it still work in progress?
We have the whole of the Pali canon. Okay, so in terms of original texts, we have the whole of the Pali canon. We have virtually all of the original texts, the early Buddhist texts in Chinese, and also most of the early Buddhist texts that exist in Sanskrit. We don't have the Tibetan ones yet. We hope to get them in the next year or so. In terms of translations, we have a large amount of suttas translated into English, but not the whole canon into English. We have the whole canon in a number of languages, Vietnamese, Portuguese, Burmese, and a few others. But not in English yet, unfortunately, because there is no version of it that is available free from copyright and in a digital form. It doesn't exist so far. But yes, we aim to rectify that situation. Yeah.
Thank you. The second question is with regards to the sutta that Ajahn shared just now about, you know, if you are terrified with things like snakes and spiders and creepy crawlies and... I would like to ask, with regards to chanting that sutta, and also in general, is there anything significant about chanting or reciting the sutta in Pali language versus, you know, would it be just as effective if we recite it in English, for example?
Well, actually, if you look in that sutta, that actually sort of gives you the answer, because what it says is that monks, you should develop a heart of loving kindness for these animals, yeah? And then these verses can help you to develop that heart of loving kindness, right? So the point of the verses is actually to help you to have loving kindness, right? It's not some magical power which is in those words, yeah? And so, yes, actually, if you understand the words in English, it's probably even better. Yeah. So I know that one group in Australia, they translated it, but they used the names of the different Australian snakes instead of the Indian snakes in there. So for the loving kindness for all the brown snakes and for all the dugites and so on and so forth. So, that's why the Buddha said that you should learn the Dhamma in your own language. Yeah. Yeah. So actually it's much better. See, when they took the Buddhism to China and Tibet, they translated everything into the local language, which actually is much more in line with what the Buddha wanted. They went to Sri Lanka, they kept it all in Pali, which I think is good because I like Pali, but it's much better if people can understand it. Yeah. Okay.
Bhante, can I ask regarding the Lotus Sutra? Lotus Sutra, any comments on that?
Any comments on the Lotus Sutra? Well, it's Mahayana Sutra. It's usually dated about 2nd to 3rd century AD. I'm not sure what other comments you want me to make. Have you got any specific questions?
Meaning like some of the different sects, like from Japan or maybe from Tibetan,
uh-huh.
they claim that they have certain power.
Yes, and
you follow
I
that
know.
You
Amazing,
get
huh?
faster access to.
Yes.
So what's your view on that?
My view is that lots of people claim lots of things. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May they all be correct. What can I say? Yeah, that's all right. If you like that, that's all right. What can I say? I don't know. Sorry, we had a question down here earlier. Yeah.
One thing you mentioned that the Australian version they changed the name of the snake and so on. Do they accept the mythological figures mentioned in the very few first verse? Do we have to accept the mythological worldview?
Right, yeah. Like you have, like the Nagas in Australia, you have the rainbow serpent, right? The woggle, right? Which is the very similar to Nagas. You know, they're like the spirits of the waterways and things like that. So in the Buddhist text, you have these kind of mythologies, okay? And actually, this is something which is going to come up with the text critical study exercise that I'm going to give you all after the break, okay? But let me just give you one suggestion here. And this is something that actually we discussed with Ajahn Brahmali, and we discussed this with Bhikkhu Bodhi in an interview that we did with him a few weeks ago. In the Buddhist texts, there are two usually quite distinct ways of talking about states of rebirth, okay? One way of talking about it is, if you like, a philosophical way, okay? Where the Buddha says, for example, say in the Second Noble Truth, it says, yayang tanha bono bhavika, is that craving which gives rise to future rebirth, right? Or when someone becomes an arahant and they say, you know, I've made an ending of future rebirth, yeah, kina jati, vusitam brahmacharyam, and so on. So in those cases, the rebirth and so on is talked about in a fairly general, abstract and philosophical sense, okay? There's another way of talking about it where it's talked about in a very specifically mythological sense, right? Where you have like Saka, who's the ruler of a particular group of gods in a particular heaven, who has his palace and he has his pink-footed nymphs, and he comes down to see the Buddha, and you have Pancha Sika, the Gandhaba, who plays the guitar and comes down and sings the love song to the Buddha, right? This is also, you know, something you should consider from a text critical point of view is when you find love songs in the Pali Canon, exactly what exactly is going on there. It's fantastic in the Sakapanha Sutta, where he comes down and tries to get the Buddha's attention, and he says, you know, he's singing this love song for his beloved Deva, and he's got lines in the verses that are things like, my golden tressed beauty, my passion for you is as inflamed as the love of that the arahants have for the Dhamma. And just as the Buddha, on sitting in the banks of the Niranjara River, was intent and passionate for enlightenment, in the same way, I am passionate and long for your touch, O my darling one. And, and yeah, going on. It's a very unusual piece of literature. Anyway, so where was I? Yes, the mythology, right? So now, once we've made that distinction, right, we make that distinction between talking about different states of rebirth in a fairly abstract sense and talking about it in a concrete and mythological sense, right? We then see that almost always those mythological passages are found in part of the background narrative. Yeah? Very rarely are they included actually in the teachings themselves. Yeah? So, for example, you look in the Saggata Wagga, where you have like many devas who are coming to the Buddha and asking him questions and things like that. And so the background has this mythological context in the narrative. But if you actually look at the verses, almost always the verses are just dealing with straight Dhamma. There's no mythological content in them at all. Okay. So from when you analyze it in that way, then it seems to me that there's a good reason for thinking that when we're thinking about rebirth and so on, that the sort of the mythological details of the Indian cosmology is not so central to the whole idea of rebirth, right? So I don't think it would be right to insist on taking those things too literally. You know, there's a general idea that there are different states of being reborn, some of which are more pleasant, some less pleasant, and so on and so forth. but I don't know whether there's an actual heaven with a god who calls himself Saka, who lives in a palace and has 500 pink-footed nymphs. But that distinction will come up in the passage that we'll assign for the reading after the break. Okay? So I think, are there any more questions we had in queue? Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. You'll be very patient.
When you analyzed the Anupada Sutta earlier,
yeah.
You mentioned an Abhidhammic concept, the universal concomitant Chetasikas. Yeah. What was the term that you used?
Sabbasadharana Chetasika.
Is that term actually found in the Abhidhamma itself or in the commentarial?
Yeah, that's in the that's a later Abhidhamma term, yeah.
Yeah. Which leads me Abhidhamma to suspect commentary. That actually the Abhidhamma is not even proto-Abhidhamic, but it may actually be from the time of the commentaries, because if you look at the Dhamma Sangani and its presentation of the states that are present in each, it starts with Yasmin Samaye, then it makes a proposition, Tasmin Samaye, Vedana Hoti, Sanya Hoti, Vinyanya Hoti, and they didn't use Ati, the existential verb, they used a very vague copula Hoti, which could also refer to the future. So it looks as if we wanted to interpret the Abhidhamma on just purely grammatical grounds, they left it open that all these states could be there at that point in time or they would come to pass in the future. It's only that with the commentarial system of the universal and concomitant Chetasikas that everything has to be contemporaneous, that you have this problem. And since that shows up in the Anupada Sutta, I suspect that the Anupada Sutta...
Yeah, it doesn't use Hoti there.
Sorry? It has Hoti, but it packs all of the things
together.
Into
one list, yeah.
As if it were using the universal concomitant Chetasika model, rather than the Dhamma Sangani model.
So you think it might be even later than the Abhidhamma?
I think it's later than...
Post-Abhidhamma, not proto-Abhidhamma.
Well, it doesn't look like the Dhamma Sangani...
That's right, yeah, it's not exactly the same as Dhamma Sangani, but there's a number of different kinds of presentations within the Abhidhamma texts themselves, so yeah, it's more of a general affiliation. I mean, it would be interesting to look whether there were more specific, I haven't looked into that, there might be some more specific things. I take your point there about the use of the word Hoti and the somewhat vagueness that it has in regards to time. I'd have to look in more detail at how the Dhamma Sangani handles that to be able to comment more clearly, but yes, generally speaking, it's certainly true to say that within the canonical Abhidhamma, you know, we're not dealing in a context that's so sort of specific and so tight in how it needs to be interpreted as it later became. So, yeah, it's an interesting idea. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, I think we should have a break now for a cup of tea, and we'll all be back here at 4.